We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in baseball isn't boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Podcasting from the top of the rocks, this is News on the Rocks with Patty Steele.
So one of my favorite things about this podcast is the fact that we get to drink together, because, you know, when you're having something to drink, there's sort of like this magic that happens. Now, the funny thing is, you arrived a little early and we started drinking a little early. So here we are. I am with Vince Giordano, who is, you know, here I got to start by reading some of the stuff you've done, which blew me away.
All right.
If you want to say hi, you can say
hi. Hi, this is Vince. Thank you so much, Patty, for having me on. You know, the early bird gets the worm.
Right.
And the second mouse gets the cheese.
The second mouse.
Yes.
Why the second mouse?
Well, the first mouse is in the trap there.
You know. Oh. Okay. Oh, very good thinking. I didn't really think of that.
Okay.
So here's the thing about Vince. I knew that I was fascinated with him because I had gone to see a performance of Vince Giordano and your band, the Nighthawks, mm-hmm. at, I think it's called Iguana NYC.
Yes.
On West 54th in the city.
Correct.
And a friend of mine, he didn't have to twist my arm too much to make me to go, because I had grown up in a family that was very musical. My dad was a jazz pianist. My mom is a singer. And so I said, yeah, this would be kind of cool, because this is music of the 20s, 30s, maybe mm-hmm. a little 40s.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I'll go watch it. And I was like blown away. So then I start reading about you, and I discover that not only are you a Grammy winner, a multi-instrumentalist, I like that, that's on your website, but you've played not only in New York nightclubs, but you've been in films, and I don't want to read this whole thing, but I sort of do. The Cotton Club, The Aviator, I love that. I loved Finding Forrester. Mm-hmm. Revolutionary Road, Cafe Society. You did HBO's Boardwalk Empire. You've done concerts at Town Hall, Jazz at Lincoln Center, Newport Jazz Festival, 92nd Street Y. You recorded stuff for Boardwalk Empire and even helped them kind of recreate that period look mm-hmm. by just filling them in, because you're a historian as well as a musician.
Yeah.
You had vocalists like Elvis Costello, Patti Smith, Regina Spektor, Leon Redbone, my absolute favorite. I just absolutely love him. Liza Minnelli, Rufus Wainwright, David Johansen. You've recorded also for Ghost World, The Savages, De Niro's The Good Shepherd, Away We Go, Sam Mendes, Michael Mann's Public Enemies. You did Grey Gardens for HBO, Mildred Pierce. I mean, it's incredible. How much? Also, music for The Joker, for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and the Irishman. You said you did some vocals for The Irishman, right?
I did a little vocal in it. I can't find it, but they gave me a credit. I was there.
I'll take it, he says.
All right.
And then I guess this autumn you're going to be releasing a recording with Loudon Wainwright III.
Yeah.
And here's the fascinating. Oh. And there's a documentary about you.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I've ever met someone who had a documentary completely about them.
While they're alive.
Right, exactly. There's a Future in the Past. That's a great name, Vince Giordano, Future in the Past, which, by the way, you can stream on Amazon Prime Video. So all of this leads me to ask the question, you're a child of the 50s.
Yeah.
How on earth Did you get interested in music of the 20s and 30s?
Well, it's a long story. I'll tell it as fast as I can. Uh-huh. I was born in Brooklyn, raised out in Long Island, and every holiday we would venture back to Brooklyn to the grandparents' house because the whole family would gather there. Sure. And on the way in, we only had AM radio to listen to, and you'd be listening to How Much Is That Little Doggy in the Window and, and Oh My Papa and things like that.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. You know, this is before rock and roll got even involved, so there was no energy. There was just kind of, hate to say the word, but schlock.
Yeah. Just...
And I'd get to the grandparents' house, and I would make a beeline for the old phonograph.
And how old were you at this point?
5 years old.
5 years.
And maybe. She showed me how to wind up the machine carefully, not break the spring,
right.
Take these shellac discs and carefully put them on the turntable and sit there for hours and listening to music of the jazz age. She was a big Al Jolson fan. She had a lot of jazz records. She had a couple of Louis Armstrong OKs and even a King Oliver Brunswick. And that was my music. That was my calling. And coming home every day from school, this feeling and this, I don't know, this great feeling would be amplified by watching old black and white cartoons that was on
Betty
at that
Boop.
Time. Betty Boop.
Total 20s girl.
The Flasher cartoons, the yeah. Warner Brothers, and you hear these jazzy soundtracks. And I would stay up and try to get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to hear an old 1932 or 33 soundtrack that was playing on the late, late, late show.
Right.
It used to make my parents crazy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of in a nutshell how I got involved.
Did anybody in your family, were they into music, like other than your grandmother loving to listen to it, did anybody create music?
No, they all appreciated music, and but no one made any attempts to learn an instrument or sing or do
so
any of that.
It's almost the unanswerable question. Where did that come from in that little tiny boy that you're listening to that and your soul just related to that and you wanted to be a part of that? And it wasn't even your generation of music.
Yeah.
It was just something you heard and just developed an incredible passion for. Your parents supported that passion?
Well, they questioned it. They they would listen and they said, what are you listening to this stuff for? That's grandma and grandpa's music. Because, you know, they were another generation. They'd be listening to music of the 40s and 50s. That was their youth,
right.
Sinatra and the big bands of the later time period. So, and I was this weird kid with all my friends running around out there in Long Island. They would say, oh, there goes Vince with that Little Rascals music or that cartoon music. That's what they would call me.
Right,
cartoon man, you know, or something. I said, fine.
Well, it's interesting because, like, now kids today actually have access to all different genres of music. But back then, unless you had a grandma that had all of those records that you could access, there wasn't a lot of place to hear that kind of stuff. You know, in a broader sense, it's one of the things we think about, whether we're raising kids, we are a kid, whatever it is. We're all looking for our passion. And once we find it, which is the trick, we're trying to figure out a way to channel it and make it into something that not only satisfies our soul, but also we can maybe make a living with. Because the greatest thing in the world is to work at something that you also love.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do that? How did you take that 5-year-old sensibility and turn it into this guy that has done all of that?
Well, in the words of Winston Churchill, never give up. No, truly.
No, that's true.
It's true. But I mean, there was a lot of hard knocks and I would get a lot of flack from a lot of people, you know, saying, what are you doing with this stuff? And,
right.
I mean, you know, in keeping a career happening, I would have to do other things sometimes too.
What'd you do? What kind of things?
Well, like when the graduation time, I let my grades slipped so bad that I wasn't able to go to college. So I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy band. And it was a wonderful experience. It was the Navy show band, which really prepared me for leading my band. But I got into it for what it was and did the job the best I could. And then when I got out, we did some weddings, you know, with the band, and occasionally people would ask for some.
So you put a band together?
Yeah, on the experience of what I had with the show band.
Right.
You know, music stands, lights, books, personalities of crazy musicians that get them together.
Right.
Details, you know, getting people all around, all that kind of stuff. And I did a lot of music that I really didn't want to do, but I had to do.
Sure. You know,
being a professional, pay the bills.
Yeah.
And so you'd get a lot of flack from musicians saying, you know, we don't want to play music from that time. Mm-hmm. We want to play more modern jazz or play our own compositions.
Sure.
And some public, you know, would be, you know, a little hard on me too for that. And I said, well, this is what I do. It's like when you go to a certain restaurant, whether it's an Italian restaurant or French restaurant, this is what you get at a certain restaurant.
And
I always look at food that way. And the person who's preparing that food is very passionate about it. Maybe he'd like to cook up another kind of meal or another kind of genre of food, but he's into that. And that's what you go for, you know, do what you do best, and just go for it. And loss of money, loss of relationships, you know, you name it, all these little things can, in trying to achieve your goal, can kind of erode things that are around you.
Well, it can erode, but I think in some ways it also helps sharpen your view because you begin to see what matters and what doesn't matter.
I have a strange philosophy in life, which we talked about. It's called negative positive energy.
Right.
And negative positive energy, so what the heck is that? Well, it's sort of like being on a springboard, you know, when you're going to dive into a pool and just really getting upset that I can't get this done, or I want to get something that's far beyond my means, and I'm springing it, and I dive into that pool.
Yeah.
But it was the negative energy that made it positive for made me to put 2 years into a project or 30 years into trying to get clarinet megaphones for the band, which is ridiculous. Most people say, forget it. I'm on to do something else. I'm just going to play a CD and hear the music.
You know,
I have to do this. This is all important to me. What I hear in recorded performances from the 20s and 30s is just at a level that's unattainable by me. I'll never reach that. I'll never get to where I want to be.
But that's the beauty of it, reaching for it.
And I will never be happy.
Yeah.
And that's the way I live. Yeah. That's the way I live. That's it, you know.
What would happen if you were happy, do you think?
I couldn't handle it. Yeah. It's just, I've been, whatever. I don't want this to turn into a woe is me.
No. I think it's artistic nature. I don't think it's a negative, actually.
I think what Edison said, show me a content and, a satisfied man, and I'll show you a lost man. Mm-hmm. You know, something to that effect. I'm sorry, Thomas, but he's my God. And, and he just kept striving right to the end, you know.
Well, to me, that's the lesson we all should take away from people like you or Edison, is that it doesn't matter where you get in life. If you think you've learned everything, if you think you have perfected whatever it is you pursue, that's when you start the spiral down.
Absolutely.
Because you're not building forward. You're not saying, there's always more. Mm-hmm. You look at that shining hilltop and you keep working towards that.
Yeah.
I understand that feeling.
I've been compared to Sisyphus, you know, the guy with the big boulder going up and down the hill every day. Yeah. There it is.
You keep, I'm going to keep doing it. Yeah. Well, I think good artists, really, very good artists, are adept at creating something that is lovely to listen to. But great artists are really obsessed with every element. And it doesn't matter if you're a filmmaker, whatever it is you are creating, I was reading an interview with someone who, with the guy that created the show Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I loved is that he was obsessed with everything in a scene. So it wasn't just a scene of two actors or people that were dressed in, you know, the early 60s Madison Avenue garb. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that somebody over in the corner, a woman, might dig into her purse and pull out one of those. And some of the people in the room wouldn't remember this, but I do, and you probably do.
Okay.
Our mothers used to have plastic rain hats that were like accordions, and they would fold up and they could keep them in their purse. And if it was raining, you would open up that clear plastic and put it over your head and tie it around your chin to protect your hairdo.
Right.
And that was one of the things that he talked about, how every single element, whether it was the kind of stocking someone wore or the, you know, the kind of slip she wore under her dress, mm-hmm. that was essential to him in creating that scene. And that's what I see with you. Was that something your parents gave you? Is that something that's just unique to your personality?
It's unique to me. I guess I know other people who have that same
feeling.
It's attention to detail.
Yeah.
It's attention to detail. You have to do something, but you have to do it as best you can. And yeah. you say, well, let's see. Was that really the way it was? And it, you know, and we try to get as close as possible to what we hear on these old recordings.
Right.
And because a lot of times when we were doing some of these films, they were first given the 78 RPM MP3s.
Mm-hmm.
So the producers, the directors, the writers, they've all listened to this. They've all studied it.
Mm-hmm.
They said, okay, we've signed on to this recording. We want it exactly like this, except in high fidelity now, without the scratches and all that stuff. I mean, we'd have to change sometimes the keys for different singers that would sing with us. We had Kathy Breyer singing Sophie Tucker, and sometimes Sophie's keys were different. Or
Right.
So, you know, but, and we would play the recording at the session. The guys would lock in and say, well, see the way the guy hit the drum here. And you hear the way the vibrato on the saxophone is, and you hear the muted trumpet, and it's nice and short and clipped and sweet. And the way the musicians sang on their instruments, they sang, you know, versus just, they didn't play the music like this. Like, yes, we're making a record for you today.
Right.
No, they had this expression,
the soul.
The soul, and that was part of the era.
Mm-hmm.
The music is a reflection of the times, and the times was a reflection of the music. Just watching those old films, the way they mm-hmm. people moved, and people were just so much more optimistic and upbeat.
Right.
Maybe a little naive, but they had lots of fun.
Yeah.
They had less, but they had more.
So it's interesting. You said something to me when we spoke last week that stuck with me. And I can see it as both a positive and a negative. You said, you know, the hard part is if you play Mozart, nobody has a recording or a video of Mozart and how he would have approached a piece of music.
Yeah.
For you, what you are going after is a sound that is still out there that can be heard, and even video of how these people looked and created, because that's all a part of what you do,
yeah.
a very important part of what you do. So I guess there's a negative and a positive to that. Negative, positive energy. So what's the negative of having that stuff there?
Well, you know, these musicians and singers, they had a very high standard, and they set for what I call big shoes to fill, because they've put their imprint on the film or the recording. And you listen to that. I said, oh my God, listen to that energy. Listen to the quality that they're producing their solos, or the tightness of the band, the whole integrity. Everybody on that recording is into it 300%, because at that time, when they were doing it, it was the music of the time. It was like the rock and roll of, I hate to use that, but I'll have to use that.
No, I know what you mean. It was that genre.
Yeah.
That was their time.
Yes. And it was very important. Well, you fast forward, you know, 80, 90, 100 years later, mm-hmm. well, people are different. You know, they're not feeling that same feeling when you go into a recording studio or make a film. So you've got to kind of get people enthused. You get musicians.
Do you get them enthused by getting really demanding, or do you get them enthused by playing with them, you know, kind of teasing them into it? Because there is something unknowable about recreating a sound from a different period.
Yeah. It's really hard. I mean, you can't come too hard on folks, but I have to emphasize to the folks that are there with me that this is important. This is really important that we come up to the standards that our previous
that you hear on the
recordings, and try to let's try to get a little bit more intense.
Yeah.
And I do my Richard Burton, you know.
Oh dear.
Yes. if you want to hear, you know, Shakespeare.
Right.
Do you want to hear me say, "What fools ye mortals be," or "What fools ye mortals be"?
Right.
You know, okay. That's the same.
Put yourself into
same
it.
Same bunch of words.
Yeah.
It's Shakespeare. How many years has Shakespeare been gone? But it's what you put into it.
Yeah. It's not just the recitation.
Yeah.
Whether it's notes or words.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Is there anything, as you look back at your long and fascinating career, is there anything you, I don't want to say feel badly about or regret, but sort of wish you had done, or anything you wish you hadn't done?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of that.
Yeah.
I wish I would have started earlier. I wish I would have started earlier, like collecting music and meeting more people while he was still alive. Mm-hmm.
But you've been doing it a long time.
I have been, but I should have been more intense. I really got intense like in the 70s, and there was a lot of people still around from those years.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot more people in the 50s and 60s that were around in the 1920s and 30s that would I love to meet, but I was too much of a kid.
You're,
you know,
a kid. I was going to say, you can't be too hard on yourself.
No, I was out there playing baseball.
It's your evolution.
Yeah, playing baseball and, you know, delivering newspapers and stupid stuff like that. But so I wish I would have paid more attention to the music and what I was set out to be. I knew where I was going, but it just took me longer to realize it and really go full steam ahead.
What are the things that you look back on and you are most proud of or most pleased that you seized on at the right time?
Well, some of the accomplishments that I have done that I'm proud of is the amassing all the music that I have. I've got something like 60,000.
Yeah, you have a house next door to your house that you store all your music.
Well,
music in.
It's stored in both houses. I live with it and don't live with part of it. Uh-huh. And 60,000 arrangements and about 41,000 pieces of sheet music. And it's all cataloged in filing cabinets. I got about 86, 87 5-drawer filing cabinets. And
how much of it do you access to use?
All of it. I mean, I go into it. I mean, I'm sure there's music in there that I will never play because I'm just running out of time. And maybe there's no demand for it. And maybe some of it is not that good anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not one of these guys that, it's old. It's got to be golden.
Right.
No, they wrote some stuff that was questionable
back then.
But my whole thing is to rescue it and preserve it. Mm-hmm. And
so this is mostly purely sheet music that you...
Sheet music and dance band orchestrations and that you give to the band, and also silent picture movie music too.
Wow.
That I cleaned out a lot of theaters. I cleaned out the Ambassador Theater in St. Louis.
Wow.
And spent, I don't know how many, 3-4 weeks there with 900 boxes of music and covered with coal dust. And I was just, you know, I think our little pieces in the film that, like Boardwalk and The Aviator and Cotton Club. Hopefully it introduced this great vintage music to more young people, because that's one of my main things. You've got to get young people to hear some classical music, some American popular song, and some jazz.
Yeah,
young people
jazz.
In kindergarten, they've got to hear what it's, so they have a point when they grow older. I remember that.
Yeah.
That's fun stuff. Yeah.
Right. What do you see? What would be your heart's desire on your bucket list?
Well, a few things. I mean, I'd love to get into a club that I could be sort of in residency more than two nights a week and just have my stuff set up, because I've got so much material that I deal with. I'm the king of schlep, by the way. You know, Paul Whiteman was the king of jazz and Benny Goodman the king of swing. But I'm the king of schlep. And, you know, maybe get into some sort of broadcast, podcast or something where
you can share this.
I could share it. And even if we charge the small admission, something like $2, something like that, you know?
Right.
I could pay my guys better and maybe make some money myself.
Are they as passionate about this kind of music as you?
Yeah.
Are?
You know, that's
because there's some very young guys in there in your
band. Yes. Yeah. And, it's been a real, real awakening. You know, these people who are playing in my band sometimes as substitutes are in their 20s and 30s. And I said, where were you when I started 40 years ago? Right. Well, the answer is they weren't born yet.
Right.
So a lot of younger musicians don't view this music as older music. They just think it's great music.
They just love it. Right.
And that's sort of like where I was, you know, 50 years ago.
It's funny because I'm a huge history lover. Anybody that knows me knows that. And what I love about it is understanding it not as sort of dusting off something, whether it's a book or an artifact or a place, but taking a look at it as something that is present. Mm. It's when you can find a relationship with, say, an historic figure or place that makes you feel like, I could have been here. Mm. I could have done that. I think that is a big part of falling in love with that kind of thing. When you place yourself in all of that, I think is really important. Mm-hmm. Do you play any private events?
I used to do more.
Uh-huh. I think it would be so cool to do like either a party or a wedding or something where you had that sort of that beautiful. I mean, there is truly nothing more beautiful when you look back at the movies, really the movies of the 30s where you had the sound.
Yeah. Look, it's 2000.
You want them to dance the way they do in the movies.
No. It's 2020 or, you know, it's newer times.
Right.
And yes, maybe the bride and the groom and maybe a few people appreciate what we do.
Right.
But the rest of the people.
I see what you're saying. The guests wouldn't necessarily.
They're at another wedding.
Right.
And they want to hear top 40 music or YMCA.
Ew.
And all that stuff, you know, or Aunt Mitzi.
Well, then they don't belong at, they wouldn't be at my wedding.
Well, you can't control that.
And, no, I know.
And it gets very hard. So
they got, did you get into fisticuffs with them or?
No. I would just have to show them my 2,500 charts that I bring.
Right.
And I said, look, we don't have that kind of music.
Right. This is
we just
play.
Don't play that music and nothing against it or whatever, but that's the way it is. So if someone asked me to do a wedding today, I turn them down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's because I really just don't enjoy it anymore.
Right.
It's a glorious celebration, but you should get either a DJ or a little iPod or something to play, to play your wedding. As much as I love live music, it's what people are conditioned to these days. So that's why I love having a club there.
Because they come because they know that's what you're going to
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Yeah, they're not going to want to hear Free Bird or some crazy thing that we can't possibly.
Nighthawks doing Free Bird.
Exactly. I had a guy come up to us at a wedding and, you know, I got all this vintage stuff, you know, banjo and a tuba and a bass drum from 1928 and you name it. And says, you guys going to play any rap music tonight? And I said, no. I said, are you serious? Yeah, I'm serious. He wanted to hear rap music. I said, well, you know.
See you later.
We're just not that kind of a band, you know?
Yeah.
So it's amazing what people
come
up to you with.
Yeah, well, that's kind of stupid. Sorry.
and that's why I drink.
I'm with you there on that one.
Cheers.
Cheers to you.
Mm.
Are there other bands that do what you do?
Yeah, there's a good friend of mine out in California mm-hmm. named Don Neely and his Royal Society Orchestra. That's what it is. Okay. Sorry, Don. And they're trying to keep that tradition alive with the old arrangements and period vocals and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, the live music industry is to me like being on a rowboat from the sinking Titanic. Mm. And there's only so many people that can be in that rowboat.
Right.
Everyone else is flailing around in the icy waters. Hey, let me on, let me on, let me get in here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I can't help you because
they'll sink us all.
They'll sink us all. And I got to the rowboat first. And I just got to protect my turf, as Jelly Roll Morton used to do in his own way. So I think everyone should do what they want to do and have to do. I like being a lone wolf.
I think it's unrealistic to think that you're going to get along with everybody simply because you do the same thing. I mean,
yeah.
There are, part of the thing that sharpens your skills is rivalry.
Yeah.
So I don't think everybody has to get along. I think you can respect that other people for their skills, but that doesn't mean that you would do it the same way or that you have to like want to sit down and have a beer with them. You know, you do your thing. You do your thing. I'll do mine and we will agree to
disagree.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. That's kind of my feeling about it.
I'm sorry to be so hard and callous about it, but
it's really a fascinating thing to see someone just find this sort of esoteric, and sorry, it is esoteric at this point, I guess. You know that. And,
it is.
And really make it something so wonderful that even somebody like me who knew, you know, I think I told you I grew up in a household where my dad played jazz piano. Mm. And he was a lawyer, but he put himself through law school doing that. And then would come home every night. And you knew that that's what daddy was going to do when he came home mm-hmm. is just sit down and just sort of unleash whatever built up during the day and play. But I never really, and he would play some of the music that he really loved. And he loved 30s, mm-hmm. 30s jazz, primarily piano. Mm-hmm. But it's really was fascinating to me, like I said, when our mutual friend David brought me over there and I saw it because it's not just about hearing it. Mm-hmm. It's visually stunning to watch the way you guys interact with one another and what you create there. And then to see people go up and dance.
Yeah.
It was like going back in time and it is really incredibly lovely.
Well, music is this special thing. I don't know what to call it, but in my early years, I would do a lot of charity work, mm-hmm. working in mental institutions out mm-hmm. in Long Island and shut in people and people who were just all huddled. And
right.
We'd start a tune, some music and a couple numbers and you'd see people start to move their head and maybe some people open their eyes and really come alive.
Yeah.
And we didn't tell them to, hey, you over there, open your eyes, come alive. But this force called music.
Yes.
Really just change them. And it's something special. And a lot of times when people come to a club that we're playing, they say, you know, I wasn't feeling so great when I came here, but I'm leaving here on a cloud, and this is better than going to my psychiatrist.
No, it's true. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you saw anything about this. Maybe a couple of years ago, the Museum of Natural History, there were a bunch of neurologists in conjunction with, believe it or not, the drummer from the Grateful Dead, did this whole thing on brain waves and how our brain responds to music and to beat. Mm-hmm. And I did a podcast with him, and one of the things he talked about was his grandmother. When his grandmother was quite elderly and suffered from, I believe it was Alzheimer's. He said you couldn't get her to respond to anything. She didn't speak. She didn't acknowledge. But he said, because I wanted to be with her and I loved her, he said, I would bring my drums over and I would just start to play. And all of a sudden, he said, you would just see her
tapping,
start to tap.
Wow.
And blink in time with it. Mm-hmm. And so they did this whole study on the human brain and how it responds to vibration in a very healing way.
Yeah.
It sets up these neural pathways that open things up that had been closed. It was really fascinating.
Wow.
I wish they would do something like that again.
Because, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Patty.
I could talk to you forever, and perhaps sometime we'll come back and talk about how to introduce some of this back to children and into schools, because that whole, again, experiential education, it's one thing to tell them about something. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to allow them to touch it, to hear it, to see it, to feel it, to smell it, all of that.
Well, think some more things and you ring and I'll bring. I'll be here.
Thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.